still waiting on one of these?
Well, thanks, and it's great to be here and great to see you out here on Saturday morning. So today, as the title suggests, we're going to solve some problems and talk a little bit about problem solving. But before we talk about problem solving in general, let's start with a problem. But first, a few little ground rules. Some of you are going to be able to solve these problems quickly. Some of you may have seen them before. And so it'll be really helpful if you don't blurt out the answer. So if you know the answer or you know right away how to do it, try to hold back a little bit and we'll keep this fun for everybody. So it is fun to solve problems. It is fun to find the solution, but it's not as much fun if you're told the solution. All right, so with that, let's talk about scheduling tennis tournaments. So this is a very simple kind of tennis tournament, but it could be, instead of tennis, it could be any kind of tournament, really. It's what's called a single elimination tournament. And so usually it's done in a bracket like this. This is an easier version of the one that you have on your handout. So this is a tournament which has four people, and I've just called them 1, 2, 3, and 4. And in this bracket, this is the first round of the tournament. So the people arrive at the tournament, and player one finds he's paired with player two, and they play a match. And then player three finds he or she is paired with player four, and they play a match. So in this first round, there are two matches. And what happens is the winners go on to the next round. And so in this very simple tournament, the two winners, so in this figure, it's player one and player three, they play each other in the second round. And that round happens to be the finals, and then there's a winner. So that's this tournament. So it's a very simple kind of tournament. And, well, it could be that there are, say, in this example, five people. So if there are five people, then we can't quite match everyone up. Well, for example, there's an odd number of people. So when you match two people up, that gets rid of two. So if we have five people, we can't match them up. So in that situation, whoops, what's done is to give people byes. So a bye means that you just don't play in the first round. You get a free pass to the second round. That's a really good thing. My son used to play tennis, and believe me, on Saturday morning, pretty far from Austin, it's a good thing to have a bye early in the morning. So if you have a bye, then, for example, player one has a bye, so there's no match here. He or she just gets right into round two. And the same with player two and player five. And in this little tournament, there's only one match in round one. But after that, we have four players left, and now they're paired up just as before. And so they play, the winners play, and finally the tournament gets a winner. So now we come to the first problem. It's one of my favorite little problems, which is this. So you're the tournament director. You're in charge of scheduling. You have to arrange everything in advance. And you're doing a tournament with 50 people. And so you have to figure out how to put them on a bracket. So the bracket's going to look a little more complicated. This is an actual bracket from the 2012 U.S. Open tennis tournament. And this is actually only half of it, because that tournament has 128 players. This is the men's singles. And this is the top half of the bracket. So you see, for example, Roger Federer seeded first. Sadly, he lost to Burdick there in the quarterfinals. But anyway, everybody plays in the first round, and the winners play, and so on. So the bracket you have is set up for 64 players. It looks a little different because it fits on a page, so it starts at the ends and works in. And your problem is that there are 50 players, so you're going to have to give some byes. And my question to you is, how many total matches are played in the tournament? So if you have to schedule the courts, maybe at several different facilities, how many different courts will you schedule? How many different matches are going to be played? Okay? Any questions about what the problem says? I don't want an answer. I just want questions if you don't understand the problem. Yes?
When you're saying total matches, does that mean like all the games in the first match, all the
That's it. The total number in the whole tournament. I want to know how many matches are going to be played. So you can use the scratch paper, but more importantly, you can use each other. If you want to make little groups, we'll take a 5-10 minute break, let you work on that, and then we'll discuss it afterwards. So how many people, don't tell me the answer, but how many people have an answer? Excellent, excellent. So does someone want to tell me a little bit, without telling me the answer, tell me how you did it? Yeah, how did you do it? Gotta talk loud so we can all hear.
Yeah, and then, like, I talked with my dad, and he said, like, you have to have something that ties. So I did, like, what would the bind be? And then I found out that, like, there's 2 to the 5 people. And then, wait a minute, let's see. So then I did, like, how you would get 2 to the 5.
2 to the 5, so you want 2 to the 5 people where? In the second round. Okay, so let's, whoa, you're too fast for me. Okay, so you want 2 to the 5 people in the second round. So we can figure out how many rounds there are. So if we work backwards, so this is our first thing that we can know about problems. Sometimes it makes sense to work backwards. So if this is the this is the winner, then we might have, in the last round, we might have 2 people playing, right? And then in the round before that, we'd have 4 people playing. So here we have 2, here we have 4. And in the round before that, you might have how many people playing? We'd have 8 people playing. All right, so we'd have 16 and then 32. So we'd have lots of people playing here. And we had 50, so if we had a full tournament, we would have had 64 in the first round. But we don't have 64 people, we only have 50. So that was your first step. Your first step is to say that you want to give some buys in the first round, so that in the second round, you get 32 people, right? So this is round 1, round 2, round 3, round 4, round 5, and finally round 6, which is the last round called the finals. Yes? You. So you had,
of 50 and a half, so that meant 25 rounds. I wrote that number down.
Okay, so, wait, too fast. So you had 25 matches in the first round? So you took the 50 people and had each of them play someone else in the first round, right?
And
okay, slow down. You're too fast. I got to tell everyone else, okay? Okay. So she gave, what's your name?
Eva.
Eva. Eva gave 25. She had no buys in the first round. So how many people had no buys in the first round? Just Eva. A couple people. Okay, so you had 25 matches in the first round. And so how many people made it to the second round then? 25. So 25 made it to the second round, and that's an odd number. We can't have 25 people and pair them up.
So I gave 1 a bye.
So you gave 1 a bye. Okay, let me write that down. So round 1, you had 25 matches. And round 2, you had what?
I had 12 matches. That's a bye.
So 12 matches and 1 bye.
Okay.
So now how many people made it to round three?
Seven.
How many players make it to round three?
Seven.
Six. Whoa, I'm getting a lot of... Eva, I'm gonna ask him. Okay, go ahead. How many?
13.
What? 13. Okay, so here we had 25 players, and here, making it to the third round, we had 13 because we have the 12 winners here, and we have the one player who got the bye. Right? Okay, good. Can everyone see that? I don't write so big. Okay, so now how many matches are we going to have in the third round in this scheme? Good. So we'll have six matches and one bye. And so now, how many players will make it to the fourth round?
Three, four.
Well, we have the six winners plus the lucky person who got the bye. So that's seven, right? Okay. So we could So we could continue in this way, and we could count. That's not, by the way, how a usual tournament would run, because you really don't want people to get a free pass deep into the tournament. But that is one way we could do it, and count, and we'll get an answer. Did someone do it differently? Yeah. What's your name?
Justin.
Justin? Okay. Say it real loud. How did you approach it? Okay, so you decided to give all the byes in the first round. So instead, let's see if I can do this here. So how many matches did you have in the first round?
18.
Good, so you had 18 matches. So that accounts for 36 players, because each match has two players, and 18 times 2 is 36. And then how many byes? Okay, 14 byes. So now how many players in your scheme make it to the second round? Well, they're the 18 winners plus the 14 who got byes, so that's a total of 32. So in that scheme, 32 people make it to the second round. See, we don't eliminate as many people. Okay, good. And so now how many matches in the next round? Good. So we get 16 matches here. And how many byes?
None.
So we're done with the byes. Okay. So we have 16 matches here. And then how many people make it over? Well, the 16 winners. And then in the next round, we'll pair up those 16 players and have 8 matches. And so we'll have 8 players going. And so on. So that's another way to structure the tournament. And to solve my problem, what do? You add up these numbers, right? 18, 16, 8, and so on. And you'll see how many total matches you get. In Eva's way of doing it, you'd add up 25, 12, 6, and so on. And you'd see how many matches. Did anyone do the problem a different way? Yeah. Okay, but is it different from these?
Yeah. Well, we don't have the same answer, but like 14, but it wasn't. Yeah.
It's not so much different?
18 plus 14 plus 22. 18 plus 14 plus 22 equals 15. So it has to have a difference of 18. And then it's like, what could add up to?
Okay.
Whoa,
that's complicated. But I'm going to show you a different way to do it, okay? So we have two different ways so far of structuring the tournament. Did anyone approach the problem differently than this? Yeah?
It's different, but it's not better.
That's okay. We're not...
What I did was I kind of made like two separate tournaments. I started with like 32 in one tournament, and the other tournament is the remaining 18. And then I just did all the buys in the 18 tournament until I got it down to one player. And so then I had these two tournaments going on, and then the two players...
Okay, so you changed the problem, which is good. So you didn't like the way I said it, with a single tournament, and so you decided to split them into two tournaments, and then have the two winners of those play each other.
Yeah.
Good. Okay, anyone else do it another way? Yeah?
Do a similar way with three tournaments.
Three tournaments.
32, 16.
All right. Good. Anyone else? All right, so let me find out what answers you got. So, Eva, what answer did you get? What was your total number of matches with your scheme? Gesundheit, yes.
49.
Okay, Justin, with your way of doing it, what was your answer?
49.
And I didn't get your name? 49. Okay. You got 49 too?
No, we got 47.
You got 47. Oh, you got 47, but she got 49. All right, well, you guys are going to have a little conference about that. Okay, very good. Yeah?
49.
You got 49, too. Okay, so the same answer, 49, popped up in a few different ways. Well, I'm also going to change the problem. And I'm going to change the problem in the following way. I'm not going to have more tournaments, but I'm going to change the number of players. So I gave you this problem with 50 players, and that seems hard. So what I'm going to do is change that number 50 to make the problem easier. Now, what should I change it to make it easier? What's a good idea? Let's hear from someone new. Yeah. What should I change the 50 to? If I want to try to warm up, right? If I'm going to go out and do some exercise, I'm going to warm up first. So if I'm going to solve this problem, I decide I'm going to warm up first. So I'm not going to try this hard problem with 50. I'm going to try an easier problem that's almost the same, but I'm going to change that number 50. So what should I change it to make it really easy, just to start? I just woke up. Yeah. 64. That's one possibility. Is there an easier number? Yeah. 2. That's going to be easier probably than 64. Is there an even easier number? 20. Is that going to be easier than 2? If I have a tournament with two people, 20 might be harder. Yeah?
One.
That's going to be easy. All right. So if I have a tournament with one person, I'm the director of the tournament, one person shows up, how many matches do I have to schedule?
Zero.
That poor fellow has nobody to play with. He wins the tournament. All right. So let's make a little chart. Can you see that? Yeah. So here's the number of people. And here's the number of matches. So we just did the easiest possible problem. We decided that if there's one person, we have no matches, right? So that's good. So I feel good. I've solved a problem. I didn't have to think very hard. And I already have a problem under my belt. So what's the next problem I'll solve? Yeah?
Two.
Good. So if I have two people, now how many matches am I going to have? Just one. They play each other. There's a winner. That's the end of the tournament. What's the next problem I'm going to solve? Three. So now if there are three, how am I going to have this tournament?
One.
One. One what? So I have three people. So it's pretty much like one of the ones I showed you. So we'll have one, two, three, and then we'll give number three a bye. And then, so the tournament will look something like that, right? So how many matches are we going to have in that tournament?
Two.
In the first round, we'll have one match, and then the winner of that plays the one who had the bye, so we'll have two. All right, well, if we have four, I already showed you that, right? So if we have four, I showed you that here. That's the tournament with four. And how many matches do we have there? How many total matches do we have? Three. Okay. And I already showed you a tournament with five people. And how many total matches do we have?
Four.
We have four, because there's one in the first round, and there's one, and there were two in the second round, and then one in the third round. So now, all of a sudden, we have this little chart, just solving these little warm-up problems. And does anyone notice a pattern? What's the pattern? Right. So the pattern is that if we have, say, n people in a tournament, then how many matches do we have in a tournament with n people?
N minus 1.
So that's pretty magical. Right? That's pretty magical. Because without doing any real work, you did a lot of work there. There was a lot of addition and subtraction and kind of complicated things. But I just, what did I do? Well, I can subtract one, but what did I do to figure out that that was the pattern? I did one simple thing. Yeah? I used some very small number of players. So I decided that I would change the problem. I would vary the problem. And I varied the problem in a very simple way. I took a number in the problem, 50, and I just changed it. And I started doing not just one problem, but a whole group of problems. Very similar problems, but I decided to do that. And so very quickly, I have a lot of evidence there for what we like to call in mathematics a conjecture. Conjecture is just something you think is true. And the conjecture is, if I have a single elimination tournament with n players, then the total number of matches is n minus 1. Okay? So I'm in a much stronger position than just trying to solve one problem with 50 players. Now I see some kind of pattern. So that's the first inkling of what we do in problem solving. We try to get groups of problems. We try to get that kind of understanding of what's going on. We don't just solve the problem and then move on. But of course, we haven't solved this problem. We just have a conjecture at this point, not what we like to call a theorem. We don't know how to prove this answer. That if you have n players, that the number of matches is n minus 1. So for 50, we do. We have a few different ones, right? We had a few different people did it. We didn't hear them add those numbers, but if you add those numbers, you get 49 if you start with 50 players. But now we should ask the question, why is it that if we have a single elimination tournament with n players, that the number of matches is one fewer than the number of players? Can anyone think of why that might be true? I don't think we've heard from you. Go ahead. Louder.
Every time a match is played, someone disappears.
Someone what?
Disappears.
Good. So every time two players step on the court or to the chessboard or whatever kind of tournament it is, there's one winner and one loser. So every time there's a match, one person gets eliminated from the tournament. And if we start with n people, how many do we have to eliminate to get a winner?
One.
All but one. Everybody see that? So it doesn't matter how you order the matches, if we break it into two or three tournaments, just every time two people play, one person is out of the tournament. That's what it means to have single elimination. And therefore, if we have to eliminate, if we had 50 players, we have to eliminate 49, then we're going to have 49 matches because each time one player is eliminated. Does that make sense? Okay. So the first time I heard that problem was when I was in high school, and I think I remember a kid in the back of the room raising his hand right away like this and saying, well, you know, every time a match is played, you know, one guy's eliminated, so there are 49 matches, and that's that. And here I was trying to draw out the tournament and count the byes and so on. So that's what we call an answer by inspiration. Just the answer comes to you somehow. Whoops. That can be the result of things. Lots of experience. It can be the result of whatever. Somehow, thank you. The answer just comes to you. And that's great. It's a wonderful feeling. But didn't happen to everybody here. Didn't happen to me. So the question is, what do you do if that doesn't come? you sit there and just beat your head against the wall. No, you don't do that. So that's what problem solving is about. It's about having techniques and things you can do when the inspiration doesn't necessarily come right away, but to help promote the inspiration. And so here what we did is very simple. We just solved these related problems. We saw a pattern, and right away we saw what the answer must be. We may not have seen the reason for it, but we're in a much stronger position to see the reason if we saw that pattern. Okay. So that's what I want to talk to you about a little bit today. And the title of this presentation, How to Solve It, is actually taken from this book. This is my old copy, which you'll see is a dollar or something, when I first read it. And I really enjoyed rereading it, I must say. It's a book about problem solving. It has lots of problems, lots of math problems, but it talks about, in a sense, the psychology almost of how we go about solving problems and gives lots of very concrete ideas for how we solve problems. And so today we'll just have a chance to talk and scratch the surface, but this book is very much in print. It actually has sold more than 1 million copies. If you can imagine a math book selling more than 1 million copies, it's quite a daunting idea. So it was written by a Hungarian mathematician named George Polya, and he spent a lot of his career at Stanford University in California, and he was a great problem solver. There's a great Hungarian tradition of problem solving, and that book is available. I really do highly recommend it. It's about $12 now, but nonetheless. Okay, so that's what I just said, that technique can really help. And technique doesn't mean that I just know the quadratic formula, I know these theorems about triangles. I'm talking about techniques, which are ideas for how we attack problems in general. And these aren't just math problems. These can be problems in other fields, even problems in life. It just tells you how to think about problems. Okay, so the first technique is experience. It's not really a technique. It's just something you acquire by doing lots of problems. So we just had a very mini version of that by solving these little problems, getting a little experience to solve our problem with 50 players. But now that we have that experience of having taken that problem and made all these related problems, we're going to put that to use in some other problems quite shortly. Okay. So, So again, I do recommend Polya's book. Okay. So here's something one of my colleagues, I told her that I was giving this talk, and she said, well, the first thing you have to tell them is to relax, take breaks, go on long walks. That's how you solve problems. So I'm carrying that out. This is the first thing I'm telling you. And it's absolutely true. So unfortunately, when you're asked to solve problems like math problems, you're doing it under pressure. You might be doing it in an exam. Maybe that exam is timed. Maybe you're in a contest and that's timed. Maybe you have homework and you've got lots of other homework. There's lots of pressure. How do you do things under pressure? Well, even here, just because we have time limitations, I'm putting you under a little pressure to think about these problems. But that's not how, say, we as research mathematicians or researchers in anything solve problems. We're not going to solve them under pressure. Okay, so you have to realize that time is not really an issue in solving problems. It's artificially an issue in solving problems for school, but really it shouldn't be thought of as an issue. And your subconscious really does a lot of work on problems, on any kind of learning. When you learn things first, your subconscious works on it, and if you come back to it a week, a month, a few months, even a year later, you'll find that it's much easier because your subconscious has absorbed it. And so here's a long story, a famous story, about a mathematician named Henri Poincaré, who was a French mathematician. He lived at the end of the, I almost said last century, but I'm afraid that's two centuries ago now, at the end of the 19th century. He's someone who's very much on the lips of mathematicians and physicists every day. We talk about the Poincaré group in physics. We talk about the Poincaré conjecture in topology. He was an amazing mathematician. And he tells this story where he was living in a French town called Caen, and he goes on an excursion to see some mines. Well, that's the first thing you should know. He wasn't a mathematician who sat at his desk all day and wouldn't go out and do things. He went out to see these mines. Okay. And when he went out to see the mines, he wasn't thinking, about a problem that he had been working on. But as soon as he put his foot on this bus, then he had the solution. Somehow it just came to him. In that moment, when he was completely free, he had let his mind go free, then the solution to that problem came to him. And I think if you talk to many working mathematicians, physicists, people who work on problems all day, everyone has that experience. Maybe in a dream, maybe somewhere. But it's really true that you have to, whether you're studying hard for, you know, a series of exams at the end of the year, like now, whatever, you have to take breaks, you have to take walks, you have to let your mind go free. That's very useful advice, but it's not so practical, certainly for the next hour and a half of what we're going to do here. So the technique that we've already seen is to vary the problem. And there are many ways that you can vary a problem. And these are some of the words that Polya uses in his book. He talks about generalizing the problem, specializing the problem. And we just did both. We took a problem where we had 50 players, and we generalized it. We generalized it to have, say, n players, where n is any counting number, 1, 2, 3, and so on. But then we specialized that problem. We said, let's not take n, but let's take n equals 1. Let's solve it there. And then let's solve it with n equals 2. And let's solve it with n equals 3, and so on. So we've already used the first two of these ideas about problem solving, generalization and specialization. So these are easy to do if there's a number in the problem. You just change the number. The number might come in many forms. I might ask you a problem about shapes in three dimensions, shapes in space. That's a number, three dimensions. You might find a related problem with shapes in the plane, two dimensions. So there are many ways in which a number can enter a problem and in which we can vary the number. All right, so here's our next problem. And this one, a friend of mine who was actually a very much a championship problem solver when we were in high school, he told me about this problem because he was at an event for this math museum. So the next time you go to New York City, there's now a mathematics museum there called MoMath. And I haven't visited it yet, but I will in a few weeks. So here's the problem. So 12 people are seated in a row, like say here, 12 people. And what they do is they stand, they play a kind of musical chairs. So they stand, they move around, and they sit again. But the rule is that they can only move one chair to the left or one chair to the right, or they can stay the same. So they can't move too far. They can stay where they are, or they can move one place. And what I want you to do is count how many different ways those people might reseat themselves. So one way is they might all sit back where they were, but then there are a bunch of other ways where they start moving around. So I'll give you a little time to think about that problem. Somebody new, I don't know if we've... Yeah?
We move right down below the number of the chair who was in it.
Okay. So you wrote down below the number of the chair who moved there. Okay. Good. And were you able to list all the possibilities? Wow. How many possibilities did you list?
34.
So just by listing, you got 34. Did anyone find more numbers than 34? Yeah, go ahead. What's that? But what? You found over 100 by listing. Okay. 243. Wow, did anyone find more than 243? Okay. So again, I'm not so much interested in what the answer is. In fact, I don't know the answer, although I could compute it pretty quickly. I forgot to. So, but I am more interested in talking today about how we get the answer. So far I've heard that people tried to list all the possibilities. Did anyone try a different approach?
I tried doing 3 times 12 and then subtracting 2.
You tried doing 3 times 12 and subtracting 2, but why did you try doing 3 times 12 and subtracting 2?
Well, because 3 times 12, 3 is the possibility that each chair could have.
Oh.
So if you... And then there's 12 chairs, so if you add 3 times 2, you would get 36. But 1 only has 2 possibilities, and 12 only has 2.
Okay.
Then you would minus two.
So tell me your name again.
Santana.
Santana.
And you would minus two. And
okay, 1 second. So Santana says there are 12 people, and each person has three possible places they could sit. So she multiplied 12 times 3, got...
He.
What?
He.
He.
He said she.
Sorry. He multiplied 12 times 3 and got 36, and then subtracted 2 because the people at the end only have 2 places to go. So somebody during the break, I think it was you, asked me, how do we check our answer? Which is an excellent question. How do we check our answer? And so let's think about checking Santana's answer of 3 times 12 minus 2. So how do we go about checking that answer? Well, sometimes we can check the actual answer. It depends on the problem. Sometimes if we get a number as an answer or something else, we can plug back in. Like it might say, solve this equation. And you work, you work, you work, and you solve, and you find the solution is, you know, x equals 47, y equals 7, whatever. And you just plug it back in to the equation. You just check, did it solve the equation? Then it's easy to check the answer. But many times, like this time, we can, instead of trying to check the answer, we could try to check what? We could try to check the method. So we could try to check her method, which is to multiply his method, oh my God, which is to multiply 3 times 12 and subtract 2. Now, how would I check the method? Well, I can only check it if I check it on a different problem. And how can I check it on a different problem? What's a different problem I can check it on? Have a smaller number of people. All right. So supposing that I had just 3 people. So what would, Santana, what would your method give?
The method would give one time.
So your method would give 3 times 3.
Times 3 minus 2.
Which is 7. Now, are there 7 ways to rearrange those people?
No.
No. Okay. So that's, again, something important we've learned about problem solving. We didn't learn that Santana made a mistake. That's not important, because if we're not willing to make mistakes, we'll never solve anything. Okay? But what we did learn is how to check the answer. And we learned very quickly that that there has to be something wrong with that method. Okay. So that's fine. That's good. So, did anyone else have another method for attacking this problem? Yeah.
I
did. You did what?
I did. 1 had only 1. 2 had 2. 3.
Okay.
3. So I thought. So I was like. So it's like, oh, there. So there must be 12 combinations for 12. But I found out 4 was.
Okay, so slow down, slow down, slow down. Okay, so Eva, right? Eva said, I found out that there was 1 for 1, and 2 for 2, and 3 for 3. And so in other words, Eva used what we learned in the first problem and tried it in this problem. So Eva said, 12 is a large number for me to count all those permutations. And so let me count when I have a smaller set of numbers, right? Okay, so we're almost at break. So if we have 1 person, then how many different ways can they stand up and sit down? Well, there's only 1 way. And if we have 2 people, well, imagine we have 2 people, then what are the possibilities? Well, they can sit where they are, or they can exchange. And if they exchange, they're still not moving more than 1 spot. So there are 2. And then she said, well, what if there are 3? Well, we can still easily list the possibilities. They can stay the same. Or if person 2 sits here, then person 1 can only go here, because person 1 can't go there. And in that case, person 3 would stay the same. Or person 2 could go here, and then 3 would have to go here, and 1 would have to stay the same. So with 3 people, there are 3. And now Eva looked at that and said, what? I see a pattern here.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what was the pattern you saw?
People slash chairs equals possibilities.
Well, so you saw that the number of permutations, the number of possibilities, is just the same as the number of people. That's what it looks like. And is that right?
No.
No, that's not quite right.
Your dad
pointed that out.
My dad said that I might have fallen into a trap.
Yeah, you did fall into a trap. I'm setting a lot of traps today. So that's the trap of trying to make a generalization from too little evidence. But that comes back to, okay, supposing we decide that. That's our conjecture. Then it's the question, how do we check our answer? Right? We don't just make a conjecture. So that's sometimes the word induction is used. In common reasoning, we induct from a few cases. We learned, you know, Dan has red hair, his father had red hair, his mother had red hair. Everybody in the world has red hair. Well, you know, it's not true. You just have to check. So we do have to check. And in this case, if we do it with four, what do we find? How many possibilities? There are five possibilities. And if we do it with five people, how many possibilities are there? Okay, there are going to be eight. So we could get all of these by counting. It's time for a break, so we're not going to do that. But someone can now see a different pattern, probably. Okay. All right. So you're seeing the Fibonacci sequence here, which is the sequence where this number, say 3, is the sum of the previous 2, 1 plus 2. And this number 5 is the sum of the previous 2, 2 plus 3. This number 8 is the sum of 3 plus 5, and so on. So maybe another conjecture based on more evidence is that these numbers form a Fibonacci sequence. And then we could easily calculate 12, we just have to keep going down. All right, so the question over the break is, why is this a Fibonacci sequence? So we'll come back after a break. So when we left off, we decided that we had discovered that these could be in a Fibonacci sequence. And we could go on and explore why that is. Once we have that conjecture, we have to figure out why it's in a Fibonacci sequence. But as I told you at the beginning, problem solving is not something that can be rushed, and we could spend the next 40 minutes doing that. But I want to tell you a few other things, so I'm going to let you think through that. But during the break, Eva, I think, came up and asked me some excellent questions. Started asking me, well, what if we take the Fibonacci sequence? What did you ask me?
You.
Mm-hmm. Right, so, okay. So she asked me, so in the Fibonacci sequence, as we see here, the number 3 is the sum of the previous two numbers, 1 and 2. And the number 13 that goes there, I may have said 12 by mistake, is the sum of 5 and 8. And so the question came up, what if instead of the sum I take the product? What if I start with the numbers 1 and 2, and then I take the product? So instead of getting, I would start with 1, 2, and then I would get the product, 2. Then I'd get 4. Then I'd get 8. And so on. Well, you could imagine starting with different numbers. We could start with 2 and 3. Then we would get 6. And then we'd get 18. And then we'd get 108. Correct. And so on. So the point is that there's a lot we could experiment with by starting to ask those questions. And indeed, that's one of the important things that that is true about problem solving, and is that when you finish solving a problem, you don't just say, oh, the answer is 49, oh, the answer is 200 and something. That's it. That's not necessarily so interesting. But what's interesting is to absorb some lessons from the problem, and even more, to figure out what's the next step. Can I solve other problems? So here in Polya, for example, the way he phrases it in his book, can you check the result? Which was the question we were asked before. How do we check our answer? Can we check the argument? Can we derive the result differently? And can we see it at a glance? So we saw that in the first problem with the tournament, right? We saw that in the end, if we have 50 people, if we put our mind in the right way and we think every time there's a match, one person's eliminated, then we can see the answer at a glance. We can see that the answer is 49. And then here is what we were starting to show. Can we use the result or the method for some other problem? Can we ask some new problems that are variations, not necessarily variations to help us solve the given problem, but variations that we can go further? Can we pose a new problem suggested by the previous problem? So let me ask you that. So we've had the 12 people in a row, and how can we ask questions that are maybe variations on that? What could we do? Anyone have an idea for a problem? So now I'm asking you, you see, you may think that it's harder to solve problems than to make them. But actually, to make a good problem is somehow harder. And that's part of an important skill. Yeah?
Allow people to move two spaces.
Good. So one question we could ask is, supposing we allow people to move two spaces. So they could either stay the same, they could move one space to the right, two spaces to the right, or one space to the left, or two spaces to the left. So now there are five different possibilities unless you're close to the end. Good. So we could ask that question. What else could we ask? Yep. Excellent. So what if we put them in a circle? Oh, before I go to the next slide. This is what I call the research patter. It's a kind of patter of research. We solve this. Well, what about this case? Well, what if I change this? What if I do this? And it's this constant asking questions and answering them and asking new questions, which is what we do in research. It's no different from what we can do and develop in these elementary problems. It's that skill. It's the hardest skill to get graduate students, for example, to go from learning in class and answering questions given to them to coming up with questions. And then the higher level skill, how do you decide what are the good questions? That's not so easy. So, for example, your question about a circle is one that I thought of. There it is. And in fact, it's not even one that I thought of. I listen sometimes to the NPR, National Public Radio, on Sunday mornings. There's a fellow called Will Shortz. He's a puzzle guy. He does the crossword puzzle, I think, in the New York Times, but he also gives puzzles on Sunday morning. You can find it on NPR. And after he went to that same event at the Math Museum, he gave the problem in a circle, although he did it with fewer people. What other kinds of variations might we have? What other kinds of problems? Anyone else?
Shouldn't I have the same neighbor that each person had before?
What's that?
Shouldn't I have the same neighbors?
Okay. So we can try to move so that the neighbors change. Or even more simply, we can try to move so that every person moves. You don't sit in the same seat. I don't care how far you go, but you got to go somewhere. Okay? That's also an interesting counting problem. So there are lots of interesting counting problems. And someone asked me, how do you rate that problem? How do you know if that's a hard problem or an easy problem? What was that problem? And my answer is, it's hard to know. Because if you look at these various variations, some of them are easy and some of them are hard. Or better said, some of them are easier and some of them are harder. But from the statement of the problem, it's often very hard to tell. So how hard a problem is sometimes not so easy to tell. And in retrospect, it depends on how you solved it. Sometimes there's an easy solution, but it can elude people.